From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib says she's canceling her trip to Israel and the West Bank after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu banned Tlaib and fellow Democrat Ilhan Omar from entering the country under pressure from President Trump. Netanyahu had said he would allow Tlaib to visit her grandmother, who lives in the West Bank, even after Trump tweeted yesterday that Israel would be showing weakness by allowing the two congresswomen to travel there.
Let's start there with our Friday Politics Roundtable. And joining us today is Beth Fooey, who's senior politics editor at NBC, joining us today from New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
And Ayesha Roscoe is with us as well, White House reporter for NPR. She's in Washington. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
So let's start with that. What is the significance, Beth, of this back and forth between Trump and these two congresswomen, now with an assist from the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, it allows President Trump to sort of tie together two of his favorite themes. One is painting the two congresswomen, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, as sort of the face of the Democratic Party. These are, of course, you know, women of color, both Muslim. This is a big talking point, of course, on conservative media as well, that mm-hmm. they are basically the new face of the party, and sort of to make them scary and sort of otherize the Democratic Party. It also allows him to talk about Israel and his strong support for Israel and to portray the two congresswomen as opposed to Israel. So it's a political talking point that for him that sort of marries together two of his long-running themes. And I can tell you, having been at President Trump's rally here in New Hampshire last night, mm-hmm. bringing up the topic of Israel and talking about how he moved the Israeli embassy or the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem is a very big applause line for him. So it's a talking point he feels like has resonance.
But
resonance.
Resonance. But at the same time, Ayesha, there are some who are worried that by getting so political with the issue of the U.S. relationship with Israel, it could do long-term damage to that relationship because, as a reporter told us today in Tel Aviv, President Trump's not going to be president forever. And if there's a Democratic president and this has gotten so political that certain members of Congress who are opponents politically of the president are being banned from the country, that could have long-term negative effects.
And that's the flip side of this, is that by doing this, you put more attention on this trip than would have happened if they had just let them come, right? And then also, you also are able to, for the people that support these two congresswomen or who even don't agree with these two congresswomen on everything, may feel like this was a step too far. And so it does make it, and it does very much tie Israel to Trump and to the Republican Party, and it makes it into a partisan issue instead of this is kind of a universal issue for the U.S., that the U.S. supports Israel.
Beth, on the issue of the economy, it was just a rotten week on the stock market, and at a rally in New Hampshire where you are last night, the president accused the news media of doing everything they can to crash the economy because, quote, they think that will be bad for me and my re-election. What do you think, from your vantage point there in New Hampshire, how central is the economy to President Trump's re-election campaign?
It's everything for President Trump's re-election. It's the only thing that is bolstering him at all right now. I mean, his polling numbers reveal that while Americans generally highly disapprove of him, a majority do, they are very, very pleased with the economy. So even with the economy being as strong as it is, his numbers are pretty weak, and his numbers would collapse if the economy collapsed. So he's clearly worried about it. I mean, he did blame the news media last night at the rally that you mentioned. But you could also tell he was voicing some anxiety about the way things were going this week. He talked about China. He talked about trade. He said he was fully on top of it. It looked like he wanted to sort of reassure people that things are not as dicey as they may look.
Ayesha, what about that? The president wants to keep the pressure up on China on the one hand. On the other hand, he needs a good economy. And this week, it sort of seems like he acknowledged that for the first time that it might be hurting the economy.
Yeah, because he pulled back on those tariffs that were supposed to go into effect September 1st. So some of the ones that would have had the biggest impact, he pushed those off until December 15th. And so he said that it was because he didn't want to affect holiday shopping. So he made clear that these tariffs do have an impact, and this move by the administration is an acknowledgement of that. But how far they're willing to go and actually trying to reach a deal with China China, that's not clear. The two sides really aren't at this point in line right now. And so it's not clear how fast that they could move to actually get a deal. But that's part of what's dragging down the global economy is this this concern about this trade war.
And there might have been something else on the president's mind last night, which is that there's a new poll out from none other than Fox News, Beth, that shows that Trump is losing head-to-head matchups against four of the top Democratic presidential primary contenders. It found he had less than 40% support in each case. And with the case of Joe Biden, Biden, if the election were held today, which of course it's not, would beat Trump 50 to 38%.
Yeah, President Trump brought up this polling first thing out of the gate last night at the rally, and he of course called them fake polls, promulgated by fake news, and of course
Fox
the audience
news, though in this case, which he tends to think is the best news.
He didn't mention Fox at all, but he did accuse it of being fake news, and of course the audience was very whipped up and started booing fake news. But you know, clearly he's got reason for concern. I mean, his approval rating has never been above about 45%. Head-to-head matchups right now are not looking good, as you said. However, there's a whole long time before we even know who the Democratic nominee is going to be, and he is going to do his best to make that person less acceptable than he is. He went after Elizabeth Warren last night, once again calling her Pocahontas. He talked about Joe Biden. Joe Biden Sleepy Joe. He even brought up Kamala Harris, who he doesn't typically mention all that often, but he noted that she was falling in polls, I believe that was the term he used. So he's already trying to sort of grab this top tier of Democrats and persuade people against them even before a nominee has been selected.
Aisha, we know the nominee will not be former governor of Colorado John Hickenlooper, who said this week that he was done and that he would consider a run for Senate. Significance of that, first of many here?
Well, eventually he will be the first of many. There's only going to be one nominee, even though we have about two dozen running now. I think that right now for Hickenlooper, it was time for him to get out. There was probably issues with having, because once your campaign is down like that, you have issues with getting the fundraising and the money to keep going. So eventually some of these candidates are going to have to start dropping out. And you may see some of that after this next round of debates. If you still haven't picked up traction by the end of this year, there may be some pressure. And there may be some pressure on Beto O'Rourke in Texas and others to try to get out, especially if they could run in a Senate race. But O'Rourke has said he's not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. There was something that just crossed the news wires today that said that the House Judiciary Committee is going to look at gun control on September 4th, which is still kind of a long way away. At his rally last night in New Hampshire, President Trump said his administration is working to keep guns out of the hands of, quote, insane people and those who are mentally sick. Here he is.
But people have to remember, however, that there is a mental illness problem that has to be dealt with. It's not the gun that pulls the trigger. It's the person holding the gun.
Nothing there about background checks last night, Beth. Do you think that the urgency will be there in early September after these shootings, these terrible shootings in El Paso and Dayton, to do something?
Well, of course, with the House being controlled by Democrats, they can go ahead and pass more gun legislation. They passed a background check bill last February. But until and unless the Senate decides to take something up, anything that the House does is going to be dead. So it's really on Mitch McConnell and on President Trump to convince Republicans and to give them cover to go for some sort of increased security around guns. And I can tell you that last night, one of the biggest applause lines President Trump got was to say that there should be nothing that prevents law-abiding people from protecting themselves. It was a huge, huge applause line. There's great pressure against Republican members of Congress or President Trump, for that matter, to do anything that would get run afoul of his base, who is clearly very, very supportive of having very open access to guns.
Well, how do you think it would play at one of his rallies to mention the fact that he has said he would consider background checks? It doesn't seem like it would work. And I just wonder, like, you know, the fact that he didn't bring it up last night, does that mean that he's lost interest in it?
There does seem to be a concern on President Trump's part about going too far when it comes to gun control. It seems often like his instinct is to have tougher laws, to have the red flag laws, to have the background checks. After Parkland, he talked about raising the minimum age for people to buy assault weapons. But he backed off of those things, or he backed off of those the age restrictions when he got that pushback from gun lobbyists. And so it seems like President Trump on this issue that he does pull back because he's concerned. He always talks about when he endorses people, he says they're great on the Second Amendment. That's one of his things, and he wants to be able to say that about himself. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why he's more timid when it comes to this issue.
Well, especially in a crowd full of 15,000 or whatever adoring supporters, right, who really are the base of his support. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC, and Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
There is one issue that's dividing the Democrats who are running for president.
Health care, in my view, is a human right. And we have got to pass a Medicare for all single-payer system.
Progressive candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren say the government should cover every single American.
I'm with Bernie on Medicare for all, and let me tell you why. I've spent a big chunk of my life studying why families go broke. And one of the number one reasons is the cost of health care, medical bills. And that's not just for people who don't have insurance. It's for people who have insurance.
Moderates like Joe Biden and John Delaney say people deserve a choice.
If you notice, there's no talk about the fact that the plan in 10 years will cost $3 trillion. You will lose your employer-based insurance.
And also, it's bad policy. If you go to every hospital in this country and you ask them one question, which is how would it have been for you last year if every one of your bills were paid at the Medicare rate, every single hospital administrator said they would close.
The idea that hospitals would suffer under Medicare for All is a common critique of a policy that would fundamentally change the way hospitals get paid. But is it true? Would a single-payer system really force hospitals to close? To find out, I went to Maine, a rural state with the oldest population in the country, where hospitals are already struggling to survive. So here we are on the main street that runs through Little Rumford, Maine. It's a charming little downtown. There's brick buildings that feel like they're from another era altogether. It's not exactly thriving. A lot of the storefronts along this street have closed down. But just like anywhere in America, really, if you talk to people here who are milling around on the street and ask them their opinion about government-run healthcare, Medicare for All, you're bound to get a lot of different answers.
I think that healthcare is a human right and that everyone should be covered, and it's ridiculous that we're not. So, absolutely Medicare for All.
Leah Nolet is all in for Elizabeth Warren and her healthcare plan. Well, what about the argument that it's too expensive? It can't be afforded.
We have the biggest military spending budget in the entire world, and I think that money could be better used helping protect and cover our people here. And it's ridiculous that we don't put that money into other things that are helping our citizens.
Yeah, it's too expensive. People, if you get free healthcare, you go to the doctors when you sneeze.
That's Lisa Nato, who's skeptical of any government health care.
They don't look at it as taxpayers are paying it. They look at it as government. I don't want to pay for it.
So to you, it feels like a handout.
Kind of, yeah.
You don't want to pay the taxes for it.
No, I don't.
Just two of the 6,000 or so people who live in this quiet corner of Maine. And they're lucky. Just around the corner, there's a picturesque river and a paper mill where more than 600 people still go to work every day. You can see the steam rising from that mill from the windows of the Rumford Hospital.
We do about 12,000 emergency room visits a year here, and we have 6 rooms. Not enough.
Peter Wright runs this hospital. A few years ago, the company that owns it was on the brink of financial disaster, and Rumford could have easily become a statistic. Across the country, more than 100 rural hospitals have closed since 2010. Rumford restructured and survived, but today Wright is showing me why Medicare for All would hurt.
We need to build a new emergency department. We need to be at least 8, maybe 9 or 10 rooms finding the capital to do that is really challenging. It's probably our, when it comes to space, it's our number one space concern.
It's quiet today. It's not even noon.
It's
so
unbelievably quiet today. I'm so
but you're saying it gets quasi-disappointed. Busy here, and you're going to need more space.
Yeah, there's many times where I come down to round on them and see how they're doing, see if they need anything, and nobody can even turn to make eye contact. It's that busy.
Here is the problem. 65% of the patients here use Medicare or Medicaid, which is pretty common in rural areas. But it means that two-thirds of the hospital's revenue comes from the government, and the government doesn't reimburse the full cost of each procedure.
It's 99% of care, so it's still not 100%. It's allowable costs, right? So it's not all costs. And it doesn't leave us any surplus funds to reinvest in our facility, to reinvest in our equipment, to reinvest in our people.
Not so with private insurance. The people who have jobs at the paper mill, their insurance plans pay much more. I would guess a lot of the people that work there eventually, you know, will come through your doors when they get sick, when they get the flu, when they break a wrist or something like that. And I bet a lot of them have private health insurance.
They do. So, right, a private commercial employer, they provides commercial insurance for their staff, and that's a big part of our survival. You know, there's a definitely a very strong interdependence of all the businesses in this community. If something happens to the mill, it happens to us.
If someone has private insurance from that paper mill, for instance, how much more does it pay you for a procedure than, say, a Medicare patient?
It varies procedure by procedure. It could be upwards of 100%. We might get $15 for an X-ray from Medicare or Medicaid, and we might get $60 or $70 from commercial insurance company.
If I'm hearing you right, that helps you offset the expenses of this hospital in
Absolutely.
A way that Medicare or Medicaid would not.
Absolutely. It's called a cost shift. There is a deficit overall for Medicare and Medicaid. There is a deficit between the cost and what we get paid. That deficit, 100% of that deficit, is paid for by commercial insurance.
That's why Wright and his colleagues in the industry say Medicare for All would put hospitals like Rumford out of business. But wait a minute.
Ms. Banthin, you talked about the fact that you thought that rural hospitals, and I've got a couple in my district, could benefit. Can you explain how they would benefit?
This is Republican Congressman Steve Womack of Arkansas at a congressional hearing in May. Ms. Banthin is Jessica Banthin of the Congressional Budget Office, a government agency that tracks the financial impact of new legislation.
Yes, because they take care of so many Medicaid and Medicare and uninsured patients today. They treat a greater share of uninsured patients than some more urban, suburban hospitals do. They could actually get more revenue under a single payer if Medicare payment rates were provided for every patient.
In other words, in poor rural areas, people who were uninsured would suddenly become paying customers with Medicare, and that would be good for business. This is something that Donald Berwick agrees with. He ran Medicare and Medicaid services for 110 million people during the Obama administration.
My only job was to make sure that elders and vulnerable Americans got the care they needed.
Today, he believes in Medicare for All, and he doesn't buy the argument that rural hospitals would wither away if they got paid at Medicare rates, because he says those rates could go up.
That is a policy that could be entered into the conversation about Medicare for All. Rural hospitals and those who care about rural hospitals, like I do, would have the ability to argue that a Medicare for All system should make more effective adjustments of payment to meet the needs of rural hospitals. That's the first argument. The second is, under a Medicare for All system, we could move far more quickly toward what we really need to move to, and that is getting away from fee-for-service payment, where hospitals and doctors are just on some kind of gerbil wheel where they have to go faster and faster to make money, and move toward more consolidated payments, population-based payments, payments to hospitals that allow them to use money much more flexibly. So we're not trapped in a fee-for-service system.
So why do you think politicians and many hospital administrators say they'll shut down if there's a Medicare for All system? Should we not believe them?
I think a lot of politicians are using scare tactics right now. They're using sound bites and inaccurate statements about what's being proposed in order to scare the public.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Back at the ER at Rumford Hospital, Administrator Peter Wright and his boss, CEO Jeff Brickman, have little faith in politicians. Brickman says it's unlikely anyone will agree to boost Medicare reimbursement rates.
With 40 years in healthcare, we all know that when there's a downturn in the economy, more likely than not, the entitlement programs are usually the first area of focus for any government to stabilize its budget. We have seen it time and time again. So unless something dramatically changes, I can't believe that we're going to see any more dollars coming into Medicare.
You were laughing, Peter.
Yeah, well, I think one thing's consistent is there's been a steady trend from government payers to pay less and less and less.
A vote on Medicare for All may be years away, and it may never happen in this politically divided time. But the stakes are high. Hundreds of rural hospitals around the country are still at risk of closing. And if they do, people like Alan Owens will be in danger. When we met on the street in downtown Rumford, he lifted up his shirt to show me a dialysis catheter in his chest.
I need it because I've been on it for quite a few years now.
You're on Medicare.
Yeah, I've been sick. I go to dialysis four times a week, and it costs about $1,000 each time I go.
So do you think you'd be able to afford a private insurance plan?
No, I couldn't. If I didn't have this coverage, I'd be 6 feet under, you know, I'll tell you the truth.
Owens supports Medicare for All, and the reason is simple. He says if everyone pitches in, there'd be enough money to go around for the hospitals.
We're open for business, but we're not for sale. That is a tweet from Greenland's Ministry of Foreign Affairs in response to a Wall Street Journal report that President Trump expressed interest in the U.S. buying Greenland. Greenland is an autonomous country in the Kingdom of Denmark. About 56,000 people live there. And joining us now is Aya Chemnitz-Larsen, a member of the Danish Parliament representing Greenland. She joins us from Denmark. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
And you tweeted, no thanks to Trump buying Greenland. On the contrary, a better and more equal partnership with Denmark should be the way forward for a stronger and longer term free Greenland. What did you think when you heard about all of this?
First of all, I was perhaps not surprised, but I thought maybe it sounded a little bit like a joke because Greenland is not for sale.
Did it surprise you that the U.S. president would be interested? This is not the first time in history that the U.S. president has been interested in buying Greenland. Harry Truman apparently was as well.
No, I wasn't surprised because, of course, Greenland has an interesting location for the U.S., but also for Denmark when it comes to military actions. And, of course, the natural resources in Greenland makes it, you know, an interesting nation.
Right. It's home to the U.S.'s northernmost air base. And apparently China is eyeing Greenland as well. It tried to finance the building of three airports there. Those projects didn't happen. But Greenland is pretty coveted, it seems like, all of a sudden.
Yeah, there's a lot of focus on the Arctic, both because of climate change, but also because of the international trade war going on. So therefore, there's an interest in gaining great access to the Arctic.
What are you hearing from your constituents today about President Trump's interest?
The party I'm representing is saying no to Trump buying Greenland. And it's very important for the people of Greenland that you listen to the people of Greenland instead of just thinking that you can just buy Greenland. It's actually something that should be dealt with between Greenland and U.S.
Apparently, one of the things that President Trump had said to advisors about Greenland is that Denmark was having a difficult time basically affording to hold on to Greenland and that this may be an opportune time for the U.S. to step in. Do you hear about that? Is Greenland becoming a financial burden for Denmark?
No, I haven't heard that. And I would say, on the contrary, most of my colleagues from Denmark here, they're saying, you know, this is not something that the U.S. can just buy. It's something that we would like to maintain a good relation between Greenland and Denmark.
I just want to finally ask you, we in the United States don't hear a lot about Greenland. What would you like people in the U.S. to know?
I would like people in the U.S. to know that there's a lot of potential in Greenland. And even though we're not for sale, we're open for business and we would like to have collaboration between Greenland and the U.S. when it comes to tourism, when it comes to extractive industries and lots of other things, for example, fisheries, which is the main export that we have in Greenland.
What's your favorite thing about Greenland?
The people, they're very welcoming, and it's a very nice place to be also as a tourist, because even though it's quite cold, we have the climate change is also affecting Greenland, and there's so much potential for so many things to experience in Greenland that you're not able to experience other places in the world.
That is Aya Chemnitz Larsen, who represents Greenland in the Danish Parliament. Okay, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Joining us this week, the original DJ Sessions DJ, Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, the very first. Travis, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
And I just remind our listeners who haven't heard some of your DJ sessions that you have brought us people in the DJ sessions that we later see go on to become huge. I'm thinking of Lorde. You recently talked to us about Lizzo before she was all over everywhere, but you find them. So I hope you've got some for us today that we can then look back 6 months from now and say, wow, we were way ahead of the curve because of Travis.
I think all five might have that potential.
Good. Okay. The first one is French Vanilla. This is called Suddenly. It's time I feel love. Some sax there. Tell us about French Vanilla.
You know, I've actually been getting really into anything sort of punk inspired with a saxophone. So French Vanilla was right up my alley when I heard this album. They just put out their second album, How Am I Not Myself? And this is my favorite record so far of 2019.
Wow.
They're kind of at the nexus of art punk, post-punk, and no wave. So it's like B-52s meets ESG meets the Contortions. And I got to see them live about 3 weeks ago. And the lead singer, Sally Spitz, is just so energetic and has a very theatrical and commanding presence on stage. And, you know, as high as the hopes that I had for the band, in terms of their live presentation were, they totally exceeded them.
Okay, well, the next one that you brought us is Too Much Money. This is by Automatic. Tell us about this one.
So Automatic is another group that sort of has been spawned from LA's DIY scene, just like French Vanilla. They are a three-piece post-punk trio whose debut album is called Signal. It's going to be coming out September 27th on the Stone Throw label, which is a label that's historically been known primarily as a hip-hop label. They put out Quasimodo's first releases and the Mad Villain album. So it's a bit of a change in direction for the label, but this is probably one of the records that I'm most looking forward to in 2019.
And what do you like about this song in particular?
This song in particular, it's really catchy, and I like how it's catchy and dark, which isn't always the case with songs that are one or the other. It has sort of a timeless feel to it. I heard that Automatic is actually named after a Go-Go's song. And you sort of hear a little bit of the Go-Go's influence in the way that the vocals go back and forth. But it's, you know, it's just got a much darker and cooler quality to it than your standard Go-Go's song.
Okay, well, the next one you brought us is by a band with a great name, Banana Gun, and this is called Do Ya. Kind of a global sound there. Where are they from, Travis?
They are from Melbourne, but that's the thing that sort of drew me to them initially as well. It's just the fact that they sort of had like this Os Mutantes Brazilian Tropicalia vibe to it. Also a little bit of like 60s psychedelic French pop. They have a very international sound, and that song that we heard, Do Ya, is going to be taken off their forthcoming debut 7-inch, so we're super early on them still, but I have really high hopes for this group, Banana Gun.
Well, and by the way, you said Melbourne the way that they would want you to say it in Australia. I would call it Melbourne, but no, you're right. And I remember on a trip to Australia, I went to Cairns, but I would have called it Cairns because that's how it's spelled. But that's how everybody says it. Even the Americans there are saying, I'm on my way to Cairns. So good for you for saying Melbourne.
You know what? At the time that I'm on, which is 10 to midnight here on the West Coast, I actually do have some Australian
right.
listeners.
So you got
to
get
so
that.
I've been called out a number of times, so I've finally ceded to their pronunciation of it.
Okay, let's get to the next one you brought us. This is by Claro. This is called Closer to You.
I pick up every time. Wish that I could rewind. Get some peace of mind. Shut up, don't wanna hear it, now I'm fed up. Wish I could say it was enough to make me walk away. And I messed up, cause every time I start to get up, and know my head feels fucked up, and I know it won't change. The things you
So a nice sound there, Travis, and I have to ask you, what do you think when artists use auto-tune like this?
So she's actually using it for a purpose. I was just reading a little bit more about this song, Closer to You in particular, and I guess she was using it just to sort of establish that there was like a disconnect between her and the person that she's singing it to. So there's like a thematic reason for her to use the auto-tune in this song in particular that I really thought was really well considered.
What should we know about Claro?
So Claro, I mean, we at the top of the segment, we heard about French Vanilla and Automatic, who kind of cut their teeth in the DIY scene. This is sort of like a different form of DIY in 2019. This is Claro sort of came up just making music on her laptop on GarageBand and then posting it to SoundCloud. She had a breakout track called Pretty Girl back in 2017, and then she followed that up with a song called Flaming Hot Cheetos. And these were all just sort of internet songs. And one of the songs, Flaming Hot Cheetos, caught the ear of Rostam, who was a former member of Vampire Weekend and a fantastic artist in his own right. But he decided that he really wanted to work with her. So they just put out Claro's debut album. It's called Immunity, and it's co-produced by Rostam. And they've sanded down some of the lo-fi edges, but it's allowed her songwriting to have a little bit more space to shine.
You know, Travis, recently we had a DJ session and there was a song called Hot Cheetos, and I said on the air that I had never had Hot Cheetos before, and then somebody sent me a bag of Hot Cheetos after that. Okay, anyway, we have time for one more. This is Kate Bollinger. This song is called Untitled.
People come and go like all the same, it seems. Got too many holes where lovers used to be. Can't be good for me, but I don't like to be lonely. Storm headed south, missed me by a couple miles. I was almost in the mouth of trouble, I was excited.
A nice voice there. And by the way, Kate Bollinger is a senior at the University of Virginia.
Yeah, she's sort of roughly the same age as Claro. I think they're both either 20 or in their early 20s. But yeah, she's actually from Charlottesville, Virginia. And as you mentioned, she's a rising senior at UVA. And the song that we heard, Untitled, is, you know, it's a song about relationship drama. But she kind of brings a... She's got a very mature-sounding voice. It kind of belies her age. And I feel like there's a maturity and a clarity that she brings to the songs. And she just put out an EP called I Don't Want to Lose. All five tracks on it are fantastic, just like this one.
That is Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Travis, great to talk to you. Thanks, as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
This weekend, people will gather on a mountain in Iceland to memorialize the first major Icelandic glacier to disappear. Researchers say the Auk Glacier officially died in 2014 because it had lost so much ice due to climate change. Now they're installing a plaque on the barren ground as a message to future generations. Simone Howe is a professor of anthropology at Rice University, and last year she produced a documentary about the lost glacier.
They call me Auk. I'm a mountain. Well, really a volcano, or at least a former volcano.
And Simone Howe will be on the mountain this Sunday. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here, Peter.
And what do you expect to see from the top of that mountain where the glacier once was? Is there any ice left at all?
Well, that's a good question, because actually this will be the first time that the glaciologist who declared Auk Glacier to no longer be a glacier. This is the first time he will be going up on top of the mountain to see if there is any glacial remnant ice remaining. So his name is Odur Sigurdsson, and he was the scientist who found that Auk was no longer able to move under its own weight. It didn't have enough mass of snow and ice in order to be able to crawl along the ground, which is required of a glacier to be able to move under its own weight. So it's exciting because this will be the first time that he's back to inspect what might remain of Auk Glacier. They call it glacial remnant ice. And so part of our trek there, after we install the plaque and the memorial, have a small ceremony, is that we will head over to the top of the crater and then descend down the backside to see if we can find any ice remaining.
It seems something of a funeral.
In a way it is. And, you know, it's interesting because we had lots of conversations, you know, to think through how we wanted to mark this passing of the glacier. And there's a couple of different options, right? We, as you said, we could have done a kind of headstone or a grave marker, and that would have sent a certain message of loss and memorial. We also could have done a more scientific plaque like you might find in a national park with all the details about Auk. And we decided to do a memorial very specifically because if we look around the world, we can see that memorials everywhere stand for either a human accomplishments, like the deeds of historic figures, or the losses and deaths that we recognize as important, like on a battlefield memorial. But by memorializing a fallen glacier, we want to emphasize what is being lost or what is dying the world over. And we also want to draw attention to the fact that climate change is also something that humans have accomplished, if you will, although it's not something that we should be particularly proud of. So we wanted to index that with this memorial.
Well, the message on the plaque that you're installing will say that in the next 200 years, all of Iceland's glaciers are expected to disappear. It says, "We know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you will know if we did it." Why did you decide to explicitly address the message to future generations?
Well, the future generations was also very intentional, and there's a kind of title on the memorial. It says, A Letter to the Future. And the words were created by our Icelandic colleague, Andre Snæur Magnusson. He's an author and a poet. And so we wanted to work with an Icelander to craft the words so that they would be appropriate to the place. And I think of the last line, only you know if we did it, as a kind of call to action to become involved and to try and reduce the amount of anthropogenic harm that we're doing to the climate and to the atmosphere. And saying only you know if we did it, I think, is a very powerful way of phrasing it, because the second person plural form, the you form, is a very direct way of speaking to people. When reading the plaque, you can literally imagine this future person standing there reading over this memorial. And so by addressing this letter to the future, by invoking the U, we're trying to very explicitly draw attention to that potential and that future.
And on the plaque, underneath the date, August 2019, is a reference to 415 parts per million CO2, a reference, I suppose, to what the level of carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere now. Why add that?
Well, we felt that was really important to acknowledge. In spring of this year, we passed that threshold of 415 parts per million. So this is the first time that human beings have ever lived with that quantity of atmospheric carbon dioxide and content in the atmosphere. So the last time we had that much CO2 in the atmosphere was during the Pliocene, which was about 3 million years ago before we had humans on the planet. And so it's a very dramatic reckoning to think through the fact that we're living in conditions that we humans have never actually lived in before. The other element, of course, is that as the future viewer of this plaque looks at that number, a year from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, that number will probably be higher. So that's a reckoning as well.
That's Simony Howe, a professor of anthropology at Rice University. She'll be in Iceland this weekend to mark the passing of the Auk Glacier. Professor Howe, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
An ominous story in a week that we learned this past July was the hottest month ever recorded on the planet.